You're listening to Gossip Int, the way to gossip intelligently. Gossip Int is a podcast that helps listeners learn critical thinking concepts by applying them to well-known pop culture events and real-world technology-focused examples. Here with us today are Karen Frost and Caitlin Hopkins. Karen Frost is a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, a Microsoft company. Previously, she spent 11 years working in the federal government, and for the last 6 years, she has also been a freelance pop culture journalist. Caitlin Hopkins is a threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ. She has a master's degree in applied intelligence, and she spent 4 years in analytic positions working for the government and private sector. And I'm Diana Duvio. I'm a senior threat intelligence analyst at RiskIQ, and I spent 10 years as an analyst in the federal government. Although three of our participants today work for Microsoft, the views expressed on this podcast belong to us alone and do not represent the views of Microsoft. This week's structured analytic technique is a key assumptions check. As Judge Judy famously said, assuming makes an ass of you and me. Probably she's not the first to come up with that line, but when Judge Judy says it, you remember it. Kind of like when she says, don't pee on my leg and tell me it's raining, but I digress. All of us have been in a situation where we've made up assumptions going into a situation that were later proven wrong. Those assumptions caused us to make a mistake or jump to a wrong conclusion. We all make assumptions all the time. The sky is gray. It's probably going to rain. The score is 11-3. The team currently winning will probably still be winning by the end of the game. We make assumptions so often that we might not even recognize that they're assumptions. When we form judgments about things, we're generally making what we would call key assumptions. Think of these underpinning assumptions as being like three-legged stools. If you knock out even one leg, the stool falls over. For example, every day you leave for work at 7 in the morning and arrive at 7:30. Naturally, you would assume that if you leave the house at 7 tomorrow morning, you'll arrive at 7:30, but you're making a key assumption here. You're assuming that there won't be a car accident that blocks the road and stalls traffic. You're assuming your car will start and the battery won't be dead. You're assuming you won't get a flat tire while en route. If any of these assumptions prove wrong, you might not make it to work at 7:30. The key assumptions check is a structured analytic technique that forces us to really think about the underlying assumptions we make and challenge them. The chances are really, really good you'll make it to work on time tomorrow. But what if the stakes were higher? What if the question is whether a foreign country is pursuing nuclear weapons, for example? What key assumptions might we be making about that? Explicitly identifying our assumptions can help make the logic of our analytic thinking more transparent, exposing faulty logic and helping us understand the key factors that shape an issue. This exercise is particularly useful in the early stages of problem solving because it helps stimulate thinking about an issue and uncover hidden relationships between factors. Explicitly identifying our assumptions can help make the logic of our analytic thinking more transparent, exposing faulty logic and helping us understand the key factors that shape an issue. This exercise is particularly useful in the early stages of problem solving because it helps stimulate thinking about an issue and uncover hidden relationships between factors. A key assumption check can also help us prepare for changed or changing circumstances. So here's how you do a key assumptions check. Step one, you clearly articulate a judgment. For example, my smartphone is listening to me and pushing ad content to me based on conversation that it overhears. Step two, you identify all the assumptions, stated and unstated, that we are making for the current judgment to be valid. For example, Google is the app doing the listening, that it has an automated method of parsing human language that can infer discussion topics. And there is behind the scenes link between this automated processing function and an ad distribution feature. Step three, and this is the best part, you challenge each assumption. Why must it be true? Are there conditions for which it's not true? How confident are we that the assumption is correct? What new information or circumstances would undermine that assumption? And then step four, the last step, is you refine the list of key assumptions in light of the challenges from the previous step. Boom, a key assumptions check. It's surprisingly fast, and you can learn a lot about how you feel about or how you think about an issue when you go through the process. Karen, last episode, you said your favorite structured analytic technique was signposts and indicators, but you told me offline that this is your second favorite. Why is that?
Signposts and indicators is a great technique because it helps us track change and therefore understand the direction of a trend. But the key assumption check is also crucial for our ability to grow as critical thinkers. One of the things that we know from psychology is that the human mind is set up to create what are called schemas. These are cognitive frameworks that help us organize and interpret information. We might think of them as rules or shortcuts. Schemas are useful because they enable us to quickly understand and categorize the vast amounts of information that exists in our environment, especially if it's new information. For example, if you look at the eye of a stove and it's red, you know not to touch it because it's hot. You don't need to touch it because you've built a schema that red on a stove equals hot. We build all sorts of schemas. They help us understand the behavior of others, the functions of objects, even how to act in social settings. But there's a trade-off for having a preconceived notion of the world, and that's cognitive distortion. For example, let's say I build a test room and tell you it's a doctor's waiting room. I have you sit in that room for 30 seconds, then I ask you what you saw in the room. You might tell me you saw a table with magazines, a plant, an anatomical poster, and an advertisement for some kind of medical treatment. But you might not have noticed the little pot of gold, a dull knife, or a movie poster that were also in the room. In fact, there might not have been an anatomical poster at all. The schema you have for a doctor's waiting room has literally changed how your brain processed images so that your brain invented things that didn't exist and failed to notice those things that did, all because it was trying to project a certain schema onto the scenario. The lesson here is that while schemas can help us efficiently learn and understand new information, they can also create blind spots or misinterpretations of information. The key assumptions check tries to prevent or mitigate these side effects by forcing us to look closely at our schemas and find the key elements on which they're based. The schema may actually be right and our instinct is correct, for example, the eye of a stove, but we need to double check in other situations. And the great thing about the key assumption check is that it can be done very quickly. We're talking only a few minutes here, which means it's a quick and easy technique that reaps big benefits.
So what's our pop culture topic today?
Today's pop culture subject has to do with lying, as it most often does. In this case, we're going to talk about a category of information we naturally assume someone wouldn't lie about. These are immutable personal details. Here's what I mean. A few celebrities have been caught lying about their age. Actress Rebel Wilson, for example, singers Nicki Minaj, Ginger Spice, and Jennifer Lopez. Even rapper Eminem at one point shaved a few years off to appear younger. And of course, non-celebrities have been known to fudge their birth year a little too. And we all know celebrities use Botox and plastic surgery, even if they claim they haven't. But while we might not blink at someone lying about details such as their age or how much money they make, what if they lied about their ethnicity, or their race, or their entire life history? As humans, our default is generally to believe what someone tells us. So we don't expect the answer to the question, what did someone lie about, to be everything. Inherently, our key assumption is that the backstory someone tells us is true. But as we're about to see, that's not always the case. I'm going to frame the following pop culture case study the way someone reading the news would have encountered it, and then we'll unpack it further. In June 2012, actor Alec Baldwin married Hilaria Baldwin, or Ilaria. Ilaria was a dark-haired, bilingual beauty who posted to social media in both Spanish and English. She claimed that although she was born in Boston and attended New York University, she spoke with a strong foreign accent because she'd been raised in both the United States and in Spain. Over the next several years, Ilaria posted consistently to social media about her pride in her Spanish culture and visiting her family that lived in Spain. In fact, these were foundational bedrocks of her identity and her social media presence. Professionally, Ilaria leaned hard into that Latina identity. In the summer of 2013, she twice made Latina Magazine's list of best-dressed Latina stars of the week. In a now infamous segment of the Today Show in 2015, which was linked to the People in Español Festival in New York, Ilaria claimed to have forgotten the English word for cucumber while making authentic Spanish gazpacho, implying English was a second language for her. But at the same time, her narrative maybe started to evolve a little, whether this was intentional or not. Sometime around 2015 or 2016, for example, she signed with a talent agency, and her official biography on that site and on IMDb listed her as being born in Mallorca, Spain. In May 2018, she was profiled for a second time by Spain's Hola magazine, which claimed she was born in Spain and her native language was Spanish. In 2020, while on a podcast, through careful wording, she implied she had moved from Spain to New York at age 19 and therefore wasn't familiar with American pop culture. So So despite some fudging of details, we can summarize Ilaria's public persona in 2020 as someone born in Boston who spent much of her childhood in both the US and in Spain, who heavily embraced her Spanish roots, and who was sufficiently bilingual that it resulted in a permanent accent. But then in the fall of 2020, a shocking charge was leveled. Ilaria, whose birth name was Hillary Hayward Thomas, was faking her backstory. Now, there are multiple structured analytic techniques that we could use in this situation. For example, we could use deception detection, as we did with Jussie Smollett. In this case, we're going to do a modified key assumptions check. So as we've just said, normally the key assumptions check looks at our own assumptions about a situation and the key assumptions that underpin them. Here, instead of directly challenging our assumptions, we're going to test claims. By testing these claims, we're challenging our own assumption that they're legitimate, valid claims. It's a twist on the technique that enables us to apply it in a different way from how we might in a more clinical setting.
This is such a fascinating and hilarious story. So what are our assumptions, or as you say, claims?
There are three main claims happening here that we want to take a look at. Let's start with the first one. Ilaria was raised in both the US and Spain. This is really the bedrock of all of Ilaria's claims. It's the key to all of her actions and her persona. If she wasn't raised in Spain, then not only does she have no geographic ties to the country, but there's no reason for her to have an accent. To support this claim, we would be looking for things like first-person testimonials from Spaniards who knew her growing up, pictures of her time in Spain, her childhood in Spain, Spanish school records if she attended school, and even possibly property records showing her family rented or owned property in Spain during her childhood. So far, no evidence of this kind has been unearthed. And in fact, contradictory evidence has emerged. According to classmates, Ilaria attended the Cambridge School of Weston, a private high school in Massachusetts. At the time, she went by Hillary and didn't have a Spanish accent. We know by her own admission that at age 19, she attended New York University and thereafter never left New York City. So where did the accent come from and when? After Ilaria was questioned about the actual extent of her ties to Spain, she said she visited Spain at least once a year growing up, but she declined to say how much time she cumulatively spent there. Not only has no one come forward claiming to have spent time with Ilaria in Spain, but Mallorcans interviewed by press outlets say they've never seen her before. Let's move on to the second claim. Most of Ilaria's family is from Spain. This is a key claim because if they aren't, it calls into question Ilaria's familial Spanish roots. In an interview, Ilaria told Extra that 35 or 40 of her family members came from Spain to her wedding. And in an interview with Vanity Fair España, she said her family couldn't pronounce the last name Baldwin. To support this claim, we would be looking for things like family photos with Spaniards or family members in Spain speaking up about the relationship. 35 to 40 people, we should be able to find some of those people. But again, if this evidence exists, the media never brought it to light. Instead, what the press uncovered was that Ilaria's parents only retired to Spain in 2011, the year before her wedding. Prior to that, they lived in Boston for 4 decades. Currently, only Ilaria's parents and brother are known to live in Spain. There's no evidence Ilaria has any other family members there. Finally, the third key claim. Ilaria is ethnically Spanish. Prior to 2020, Ilaria's identity was largely built around her identity as a Spaniard. She told stories about being mistaken for being a nanny in New York because she didn't look American, and posted about what it was like to be a Latina woman. She was the Latin correspondent for news sources and was invited to speak on Latin topics. Her ethnicity is a key claim because if it's wrong, it suggests she appropriated the experiences of another ethnicity in an effort to benefit herself. To support this claim, we would be looking for actual blood ties to Spain. This is similar to the second claim, but moves from a geographic link to a genealogical one. In this case, we know there's no blood tie. Her mother's side of the family is from Massachusetts, while her father's side is from Vermont. In fact, her father once posted in a blog that he had no Hispanic blood at all. After news outlets began to question her backstory, Ilaria herself took to Instagram to refer to herself as a white girl from a white family. So by her own admission, she invalidated this claim. What we learn from going through this exercise is that all three of the key claims ended up being incorrect to a greater or lesser degree.
So what you're saying is that she just flat out lied.
Yes and no. It's more nuanced than that. Ilaria definitely tried to manipulate perceptions of her identity to fit her preferred narrative. She admitted to having been born in Boston, for example, but tried to fudge the details of her upbringing, talking about splitting time between the US and Spain and her parents living in Spain in order to insinuate Spanish roots without outright claiming them. But while her fake accent was definitely a fabrication, and she blatantly misrepresented the depth of her family's ties to Spain, her love of Spanish culture is clearly real. Nor can we discount the possibility that she really was raised in a household with some degree of Spanish influence. In a blog post, once again, her father noted his love of Spanish culture. He learned Spanish in high school and traveled throughout South America, then received an undergraduate degree in Spanish literature. So while it's easy to accuse Hilaria of a massive deception, parts of her story may be true. We just don't know how much, and her family isn't talking. What this modified key assumption check leaves us with is someone who doesn't have the ethnic or geographic roots she claimed, but who loves Spanish culture enough to have native fluency in the language and to know many of the cultural reference points for it. Someone who has given her children Spanish names and adopted what she considers to be a multicultural life for over a decade, even if she isn't originally native to that culture. Unfortunately, while it's great to enjoy another culture and want to celebrate that culture, it's absolutely problematic that she, a white woman from Massachusetts, took opportunities that were meant for Hispanic women, and hence the backlash she received when her true roots were discovered. There's a difference between identifying with a culture and identifying as that culture, and she crossed the line.
I feel like pop culture is an area where we could make a lot of key assumptions, right?
Absolutely. The entertainment industry is really all about creating personas, and fans tend to forget that the people we see in interviews or even posting on social media likely aren't completely representative of the celebrities themselves. So we can easily fall into assumptions that are related to those personas. It's a terrible example, but think of Bill Cosby. A key assumption that many people likely fell into was that he was like his character Cliff Huxtable on The Cosby Show. And yet in real life, America's dad has been accused of sexual assault spanning a period of 43 years by over 33 women.
And that applies to the comedian Ellen DeGeneres too, right? Her talk show looked so positive and happy from the outside. And then in 2020, employees leaked to the media that the set was really toxic. And the show ended up terminating this year as a result of that backlash.
Right. The key assumption there, or at least among the general public or viewers, was that Ellen in real life was just as bubbly and friendly as her on-air persona. But before that, there had been decades of underground chatter from individuals reporting that in individual interactions with them, she had been mean or cold or distant. It was only that this chatter made it to the mainstream in 2020. To give a positive example, though, most people probably don't know that former pro wrestler turned actor John Cena has filled more Make-A-Wish requests than anyone else. He's granted over 650 wishes, basically triple the next closest celebrities, wrestler Hulk Hogan and race car driver Jeff Gordon. So while we might, without any basis, assume pro wrestlers wouldn't be invested in giving back to charities associated with children, two wrestlers are the top wish fulfillers. One of the difficulties in applying a key assumptions check to pop culture is that while we might be able to come up with assumptions and what evidence we would need to see to confirm or disconfirm them, we might never be able to gain access to that evidence. So for example, let's take the very long-standing rumor that singer Dolly Parton has been in a long-term relationship with her childhood friend Judy Ogle and that her husband Carl Dean is just a cover. We can come up with a list of key assumptions for the situation and the evidence we might see associated with those key assumptions. But would we ever be able to prove anything? No, we have no idea what's happening behind closed doors. So there are some topics for which any of the legwork we do ends up being more theoretical than practical.
So Caitlin, how are we going to relate a key assumptions check to tech?
I'm going to apply a key assumptions check to cyber attack attribution. For listeners, the three of us work in cybersecurity, and attribution is something we do frequently in this field. Who stole tens of millions of dollars from the Bank of Bangladesh? Or who doxed a CEO or impersonated the president of a college? These questions can have high stakes, so we want to make sure we can get it right. For example, misattribution could cause a company to alter its tactical and strategic business decisions, such as where to direct security resources and with whom to do business. So the key assumptions check is a particularly important structured analytic technique for us to use when we're attributing attacks because it helps us eliminate our confirmation bias. As we've discussed in previous episodes, confirmation bias is a term for the human propensity to only seek out information that supports a pre-established position or idea. In the case of a cyber attack attribution, we might fall victim to our own confirmation bias if we search for or interpret evidence that only supports the hypothesis that a certain threat actor carried out the attack. By doing this, we could misattribute the attack.
Okay, so our example will be a cyber attack attribution. What's the story?
Our example comes from an account takeover incident that happened in July 2020. In a social media account takeover, a hacker hacks into someone's accounts for some sort of nefarious purpose. It could be defacement, maybe, for example, making it sound like the account holder is a racist or a sexist or something. Or maybe it's financial, running some sort of scam. In this particular incident, the hacker managed to take over the accounts of some of the biggest names in the world as part of a Bitcoin scam. The hacker used the verified Twitter accounts of former President Obama, Elon Musk, and Kim Kardashian, among others, to post near identical messages. If users sent the celebrity account Bitcoin, the celebrity would then send back double the amount. If this sounds too good to be true, of course it was. There's really no such thing as free money. So initially, only the Twitter accounts for select cryptocurrency exchanges like Binance, Coinbase, and CoinDesk were hacked. But then the hacker began to take over the accounts of high-profile individuals and companies. So in addition to the names I already gave, the scam also affected Apple, Uber, Joe Biden, and Bill Gates. In total, 130 accounts were compromised, though only 45 were actually used to tweet the scam message. But within minutes, more than 320 transactions had already taken place on one of the hacker's wallet addresses, and a Bitcoin value of more than $110,000 had been deposited before the messages were removed by Twitter. So now to apply our structured analytic technique. I'm going to apply the key assumptions check in a way that's similar to how Karen did it. We're going to use the evidence that investigators had at the time and the evidence we would expect to see in order to check our assumptions and determine which threat actor or type of threat actor perpetrated the attack. So to start, we'll assume three scenarios. First, that the attack was carried out by some sort of skilled and organized advanced persistent threat group or advanced cybercriminal group. Second, that it was carried out by a Twitter employee. And third, that it was just a regular old cybercriminal.
Wait, so you're going to do a key assumptions check within a scenario structured analytic technique?
Basically. In theory, we apply structured analytic techniques in a very cut and dried way. The technique is specifically chosen to target specific aspects of a problem, helping us to reduce our biases and spur thinking. But in practice, we can apply multiple techniques to a single problem or apply a single technique in a hybrid form. In this case, each scenario carries its own key assumption. Is this the textbook application of a key assumptions check? Maybe not. But if we can be flexible in how we apply techniques, then we can develop agility in our critical thinking. So let's look at our first scenario, that the hacker who took over these accounts is part of an advanced persistent threat group or is an advanced cyber criminal. Our key assumption here is that it must be hard to hack all those high profile accounts. Surely Elon Musk has multi-factor authentication and other security protocols on his account, not to mention a company like Apple. If the actor individually accessed the accounts, it must have taken significant resources and ability. If Twitter itself is hacked, then the accounts taken over as part of the downstream consequences, we might assume that the hacker was advanced enough to be able to access Twitter's network and then navigate it to find the targeted accounts. But what evidence would support the key assumption that it would take sophistication to do these account takeovers? Well, proof that multi-factor authentication on the accounts had been overridden or surpassed, or maybe the use of a zero-day exploit or some other sophisticated access vector into Twitter. In this case, we might also think about disconfirming evidence. For example, if the hacker was sophisticated enough to bypass security protocols, would it make sense that all they would do is send out an unsophisticated scam tweet? Or to put it another way, if you were a hacker for the Russian military and had access to then presidential candidate Biden's Twitter, would you really just use that access to beg people for fractions of Bitcoin? Additionally, if this has been a hacking by a sophisticated cybercriminal group, we would then have expected follow-on cybercriminal activity, what we might call daisy chaining, which we do not end up seeing here. So next, let's look at our second scenario, a Twitter insider. It would be hard to access 130 accounts individually. Therefore, it would make sense for this hack to have started from a centralized access point, and a Twitter employee might have that easiest path to reach this point. Our key assumption is that there are employees in Twitter that could have that kind of access. So what evidence would support the key assumption that a Twitter employee could conduct account takeovers? In this case, we don't have great insight from the outside into how Twitter partitions access to protect its customer accounts, but we might see evidence of other times Twitter employees have abused their position to wrongfully access accounts. In this case, we do know insider incidents have occurred. For example, in 2019, two Twitter employees were indicted for cyber espionage. They sold the Saudi Arabian government the user data of 6,000 Twitter users, including Saudi political dissidents. But in the case of our July 2020 attack, there may be evidence supporting our key assumption. After the incident, Vice reported that hackers had paid a Twitter employee to grant them access to internal systems, citing, quote, four sources close to or inside the underground hacking community. However, and in line with our challenging of assumptions and evidence, the Twitter employee whose account the hacker first compromised did not have access to the internal tools that would allow the hacker to take over other Twitter user accounts. So is it possible that the Vice sources were mistaken?
I feel like so far everything in the story is muddled. I can't figure out which scenario seems the most plausible. So is there better evidence for the third scenario?
Scenario three is an unsophisticated, regular old cyber criminal. Our key assumption in this case is that all of the account takeovers could have been conducted by unsophisticated methods, for example, guessing passwords. What evidence would support the key assumption that it's possible for basically anyone to crack Elon Musk's Twitter account? We would have to know more about the accounts themselves. How is the login protected? And for example, could you run brute force password attacks where a computer tries to guess every combination of words and numbers? If the accounts were not protected by multi-factor authentication, that would support our key assumption. Another key assumption is that if it was an unsophisticated, run-of-the-mill criminal, we wouldn't see cyber espionage. In essence, the hacker is just using these accounts to make a quick buck rather than steal company secrets, or in the case of politicians, insider political information. Something else we saw in this incident that pointed to a low-skilled hacker is that the Bitcoin scam phase of the attack was poorly orchestrated. Because the hacker sent out identical scam tweets from compromised Twitter accounts, Twitter could easily detect and remove them as the scam they were. And most significantly, the hacker basically burned a highly valuable exploit, one that Twitter would likely have paid a sizable bug bounty for, or that could have been sold on the dark web for a large amount of money in order to steal a small amount of fairly traceable Bitcoin.
So who actually took over the accounts?
It ended up being three loosely affiliated, unsophisticated cyber criminals. Just 2 weeks after the incident, a 17-year-old, a 19-year-old, and a 22-year-old were charged. In fact, authorities actually say the 17-year-old was the mastermind. He gained initial access to Twitter's internal systems and then used social engineering to bypass two-factor authentication for control of actual accounts. And one of the really big red flags here is that for all the accounts access and all the key information the hackers could have stolen, all they did was post some super scammy tweets and got a few Bitcoin. Of all the evidence in this case, that might have been the most important sign pointing us to an unsophisticated actor.
Fascinating stuff, Caitlin. The structured analytic technique that we'll be looking at in the next episode is called high impact, low probability. We'll talk about what would happen if a major singer was exposed as a fake, or if a foreign adversary turned off America's lights or internet. See you next time on Gossip It.